Hello and welcome to the Libertarian Podcast from the Hoover Institution. I'm your host, Troy Senek, and the Libertarian is Professor Richard Epstein, the Peter and Kirsten Bedford Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution, the Lawrence A. Tisch Professor of Law at NYU, and the Senior Lecturer at the University of Chicago. Today, the last word on Michael Flynn. And Richard, just last week, the Justice Department, under the direction of Attorney General Barr, announced that it was dropping its case against Michael Flynn, who was the original national security advisor in the Trump administration. And our listeners may remember that there was a scandal around Flynn having lied to Vice President Pence about his contact with the Russian ambassador during the transition, a number of other things that have spilled out since then. But let's just start with the basics here. The media coverage of this decision from the DOJ has gone decidedly in one direction, which is to say that Attorney General Barr is doing the president's bidding here, and implied at the sake of, you know, his own integrity, that this is clearly a case of politics triumphing over what the law demands. Is that how you see this case?
No, it's never been the way I've seen this case. This is basically a problem that goes back a very long time. Jeff Sessions was for a long time the attorney general, and he was effectively neutered over all of these issues because of the potential conflict of interest that he had. And this meant that he had to absence himself from this. So Rod Rosenstein took over. And then all of a sudden, what we do is we have a good friend of him and a good friend of Jim Comey, Robert Mueller, being in charge of the particular investigation. What happens is Barr comes in, and this is a very different beast. He has no conflict of interest. He had been a lawyer in private practice, a general counsel, I think it was at Verizon. And he wrote in June of 2018 a very powerful letter explaining as a citizen why he thought that the obstruction of justice charges that were being bandied about at the time were not sufficient. I commented on that letter when I did my Hoover column, and I said I thought it was a much more careful analysis than anything that came out of the Mueller camp at that particular point in time. And one of the things that I should have said, because it became very apparent, was that not only was this powerful, but it meant that Barr was a man to be reckoned with, because he was not going to be neutered by conflict of interest rules, and he had a very strong and decided view of what happened. Well, the anti-Trump people are essentially implacable. They are always anti-Trump. As you know, my view is I'm a Trump a la carte man, either for or against, but I try to look at these things separately. And so what you have to do is you have to find a way to get Barr, which means that each and every decision that he makes is something that you have to decide is beyond the pale. And so the first round of situation was when he issued the four-page summary of the report, in which everybody on the left side of the spectrum denounced this as a biased and impartial and non-sympathetic or representative view, and that you had to reduce the whole thing. Now, remember, the legal obligation was not to release anything at all. He could have released a summary, could have released nothing. All he had to do was to essentially, if he followed a non-prosecution statement, not prosecute the case. But he did release it, and a half a loaf was not enough. And so from that time on, every single decision that he makes, every person that he appoints is going to be subject to challenges. So it turns out he points this guy Durham to look into some of the complications associated with the Operation Crossfire, Hurricane, whatever it's called, the basically the electoral situation between July 1st, roughly speaking, 2016, and basically the end of January of 2017, and all that's going on there. Every appointment he makes is regarded as basically suspect. He appointed somebody in this case to write him a report. Doesn't matter. It's only what Barr does. So he basically is a man who has a target on his back, because people understand that it's not that he's incompetent. They understand that he's very competent, and they understand that he's not going to easily slink off into the night and disappear. So that's why I think the charges are going to be extremely powerful against him. And the hard question one has to ask is just how bad a job did he do? Well, it turns out Barr is a very good lawyer, and the kind of paper that he wrote bears none of the histrionics that are associated with the criticisms on the other side. It begins with a fairly detailed narrative of everything that was started to be said by various kinds of people. You start reading all of this stuff, and what you're crying out for is somebody who disagrees with it to say either the quotations are false or they have to be put into context, instead of simply announcing that this is a rule of law violation. The saddest illustration of this was former President Obama, who's a lot, I suspect, to be worried about in all of this, who announces that they put this guy off for perjury. Now, this was not a case of perjury. This was a plea that was taken with respect to the conversations that he had with FBI agents, one of whom was Peter Strotz, who later was forced to resign during the Mueller investigation, not the best of situation. And so the real ultimate issue that one wants to ask is not whether Flynn lied, although there is pretty strong evidence to suggest that they're pushing hard to make what his equivocal remarks a, quote, lie. But in all criminal procedures, given the enormous power of the state, there has to be some counterweight to protect the innocent and to protect the guilty so that criminal procedures cannot operate on the same basic lines that are operated on when you're doing ordinary civil litigation. The government has too much power, and so you think of it as a bull, and then the question is you got to take a bunch of bows and arrows and sticks and put it into its flanks so it's strong enough to function, but not strong enough to run over everybody one way or another. So the central problem has always been, and this is an illustration of it, what are the risks of and the needs for prosecutorial discretion. It is, I think, the central problem in trying to deal with the enforcement at either the state or the federal level of the criminal law.
Well, that was going to be precisely my question for you, because you've heard some people say, a lot of people actually, in the aftermath of this, that, well, look, this guy Flynn, he just got off scot-free, which, of course, he didn't. Regardless of whether you think, how you think he should have been treated here, he went through a process that cost him a lot of time, cost him a lot of money, cost him a White House job. You know, the argument has been made that the process was very much the punishment here. So that plays to exactly the point that you were making there. What are the mechanisms that we need to think about and the principles by which, you know, you obviously need these prosecutors to do their jobs in the right moments, but how do you constrain them from excess and from the ability to ruin people's lives in cases like these?
Well, look, what I always do is I start back a degree and I say to myself, well, how does this work in competitive industries? How does it work in monopoly industries, wholly apart from the criminal process? And the answer is, if you're in a competitive industry and you're trying to sell somebody goods, and what you do is you demand a very high exaction, what they will do is go elsewhere. And what happens is competition from other people is the single best defense that you have against being exploited. We then switch over to monopoly positions, common carriers, public utilities, and so forth. Those rules just aren't there. If you don't go to the guy who's going to supply you with electricity, you're out of electricity, you're going to be out of power, you can't function in a modern society. So what we've always done is we've imposed duties upon monopolists of fair play. And the typical one here is they have a duty of universal service, and the only distinctions that they can make in the cost of service are based in the cost, in the price of service are based on the kind of cost of service that they have. And they're just huge, complicated doctrines which are designed to make sure that this particular monopolist can stay in business while recovering his capital and a normal profit on his operation without allowing him to pick and to destroy other individuals. Well, when you get to the government, you start off with the first question is, can we have a competitive industry in prosecutions? Well, you cannot run a system in which 10 people come up and say, I'd like to prosecute this case, and then you tell the accused, you pick the prosecutor whom you want most to take after you, because there'll be somebody there who's willing to offer an acquittal with no questions asked, and you'll always pick that particular guy. And so you do have competition amongst prosecutors, but that makes things worse, not better, because you get a federal prosecutor with monopoly power, then you get a state prosecutor with monopoly power, multiple offenses, and each of these guys can beat you to an inch of their life. And what you really need to do is to make sure that one of them only is going to take the lead. You can't be faced with both of these guys together. Interestingly enough, one of the protections we give against prosecutors abusing themselves is the so-called double jeopardy provision, but it's been long established American constitutional law that double jeopardy only arises if you're sued twice within the same jurisdiction. It is not double jeopardy to prosecute you first under state law. If that fails, then for the federal government and to prosecute you for the same offense. So you can see that the tag team game is one that's very, very real. And even if you don't make this a constitutional guarantee, there is some concern. So What you then do is you're going to have only a single prosecutor. But this guy has the infinite purse of the government behind you. He could select anybody whom he wants to push extremely hard. So the whole business in this game is to figure out how you defang the prosecutor so as to prevent various kinds of abuse. And you could literally, if you want to talk about this, go into one device after another, which is essentially designed to make sure that the overly powerful prosecutor can be cut a little bit down to size.
Well, can we talk a little bit about those devices? Because I was going to give you a somewhat abstract hypothetical. Abstract because neither Donald Trump nor Joe Biden really works for this. But let's just say that in 2020, a generic Republican were elected president. If that person were looking to get the affairs of the Justice Department and the FBI into good working order, what would be some of the recommendations you'd make in terms of reforms or policy changes?
Oh, well, essentially most of these reforms would be directed to the question that I've put. How is it that you're going to stop various abuses from taking place by renegade prosecutors who are too powerful for what they do? So let's just go back historically. There's a device known as the Deferred Prosecution Agreement, the DPA. And what happens is you are going to prosecute somebody and you tell them, look, I will not prosecute you so long as you are willing to agree to an agreement which will put you under very serious restrictions. Now, it turns out when you prosecute somebody for a criminal offense, there are usually upper bounds as to what's going to happen, but there are also collateral consequences independent of the criminal system. So if I prosecute you as a bank officer for bank fraud or you as a securities guy for securities fraud, not only do you have to pay a fine of $5,000 and go to jail for 90 days or whatever, but you'll be barred from the profession, which will cost you an infinite amount. And so what happens is prosecutors say that. They say, look, I mean, it's just a small punishment, but this large collateral offense, you'll be better off if you take an agreement with us whereby what you do is you agree to have us watch all of your situations, have ability to re-prosecute you at any time, because that's going to spare you from the loss of your license, and we'll take over your corporation, we'll run it, everything going on. And this was done both in the late Clinton years and in the early Bush years, and it really gave rise to tremendous resentment. And there's a judge named Lewis Kaplan who, in I think a case involving Pete Marwick, tried to put something of an end to this. So what you have to do when you get these kinds of cases is you have to tell the prosecutors there's certain kinds of things that you cannot threaten people. So, for example, in the Pete Marwick case, one of the things they said is, well, you know, Pete Marwick will let you off of this charges, but you agreed to pay the legal expenses of people who are going to be subject to individual charges, and we want you to renege on those promises. And you know, Kaplan said, you can't do that, because what happens is then you're leveraging your power against one guy to allow you to beat up on another kind of guy. And so what you always have to do is essentially make sure that in these kinds of agreements, you cannot have a prosecutor threaten to essentially cut off the support from some other guy. There are even some prosecutorial cases that I've been familiar with. They say, look, we think that there's some real question as to whether this pot of money is one that you owe. And so what we're going to do is to tell you, you can defend yourself, but you can't defend it with any of the resources that you have, because we want to have a prospective lien on that. And I think a judge may want to say, well, you can't get rid of all of those restrictions and give the money to your uncle or whatever it is, or your niece or your spouse. But I think that there really has to be judicial oversight of this so that ordinary expenses of defense can now be covered by these particular people. So that's the second kind of situation you want. Well, here's a third thing. The government has a lot of information about this guy, some of which is exculpatory. One of the things you would do in a civil case is you let somebody go through and take discovery. There's no way that you could ever allow any civilian to run ransacked through the prosecutor's office and get all of those records. There may be huge amounts of confidential information on very sensitive issues, very bad people, and you just can't allow this stuff to go to a defendant who can then blab it to the rest of the world. So there's been something known as the Brady Rule, which says, in effect, the prosecutor is under a duty to turn over exculpatory evidence to the defense so that it can make it in a more informed fashion. You don't have discovery, you have to do this. And one of the issues that's now being raised in connection with the Flynn case is it was clear that the government had tapes of all the conversation that Flynn was in, which to my mind means that they should never ask him about things they already know about. But even if they could ask him, are they under a duty to give him that information before they start to question him, or are they under a duty to give that information after they question him, trap him in what they think to be a lie, about to give a sanction? Are they supposed to turn that stuff over so that you can now have a stronger case of showing that there's prosecutorial misconduct? And I think the answer to that particular question is that this information probably ought to be turned over, which means that you void the plea, and then the government has to come back the second time if it wants to charge this case, knowing that key information is now in the hands of the defendant so that it can do this. Now, no matter what you do in the criminal law, this problem is there. It's the same problem you face in labor law. Management is a monopoly position against unions. Unions have a monopoly position against management. And in each case, we say there's certain kinds of things that you're not allowed to do because what they do is they upset the balance in that situation. The big difference is you don't need to worry about unions if you have competitive markets. But as I said to you, there's no competitive solution here. And the final one, just to mention, is this: what about a settlement? My colleague from the University of Chicago for many years, Al Alshuler, wrote piece after piece saying, we just don't want any of these settlements to take place because the government has too many hands. Well, does that mean you try every case to a jury? That becomes madness. So what you then start to do is to say, well, this is kind of like class action. And if you're going to settle one of these cases out, you have to have a judge who could look at everything that went on, both in terms of procedure and in terms of punishment, to decide whether or not it's excessive under the circumstances. So this is a really endemic kind of problem. And I think that all of these kinds of safeguards that you normally want, once you got into this special prosecutor with Mueller, was systematic. Disregarded.
All right. You've been listening to the Libertarian Podcast with Richard Epstein. Remember, you can read Richard's column, The Libertarian, at definingideas at hoover.org, and you can follow him on Twitter at Richard A. Epstein. And if you enjoy the show, please rate it on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. For Richard Epstein, I'm Troy Senek. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution, where we advance ideas that define a free society. For more information about our work and to hear more of our podcasts or see our video content, please visit hoover.org.